him, then turned and placed himself in front of the man. Warren was suddenly tense. He squinted at Cormac and drew his sword.
Clear the way.
I respectfully decline, Mr. Warren. I want that sword. It belonged to my father. Warren raised the sword as Cormac took a dirk from his belt.
This is my sword, Warren said. I paid for it. I own it. And if you don't leave, you'll taste it quick.
I want that sword. Warren took another step, put his weight on his left foot, and swung. Cormac stepped inside the arc and deflected the sword with the dirk. Another swing knocked the dirk from Cormac's hand. Then Warren charged, lifted the sword to finish the fight, and Cormac stepped inside the arc of his swing, grabbed Warren's right arm, and spun him, slamming him against a wall. Warren dropped the sword.
You'll be hanged for this.
Perhaps. Cormac picked up the dirk. Warren jerked a pistol from inside his coat. Cormac didn't wait. He rushed Warren, pushed the gun hand aside, and drove the knife into his chest. Warren's eyes widened. Then he fell to his side on the wet street with the knife handle jutting from his heart. Cormac picked up the sword and walked quickly into the rainy wilderness of burned houses. Something went out of Cormac after he killed Tony Warren and recovered the sword. He could feel it in his bones and in the odd lack of feeling about killing another man, another Warren. Tony Warren was a mean man, the Earl without the smile or the juggling, but he felt no satisfaction. He continued working with the Africans on small acts of sabotage and carried his sword with him, strapped again across his back. But after Tony Warren, he never killed another British soldier.
You lost something, Cormac, said Quacko one evening.
I did, said Cormac, and I don't know what it is.
The news came about Yorktown and the end of the war, and Cormac celebrated with Quacko and his wife. The war finally settled, the treaty was signed, a date set for the departure of the British armies. Nobody talked about the Africans. Now the Tories were leaving by the many thousands, boarding boats for Canada and England, carrying with them huge trunks and crates of goods and their slaves. On the ships, many of the Africans were smiling. They were going, they truly believed, to freedom. In late summer, many Americans who had supported the revolution began to return to see what was left of their lives. Most of their businesses had been destroyed by fire, but they began to sketch out plans for what would rise from the ashes. They would drain the swamps and level the hills. They would build stone buildings. They would dig deep wells for water. They had clear ideas about individual liberties, with one major exception. Slavery would continue. They began searching for their own slaves, forming small posses of armed men to gather them as if they were stray horses. On many nights, Cormac went sleepless with rage. On evacuation day, the victorious army of George Washington came into New York through McGowan's Pass. Cormac wandered alone to South Street to watch the last British ship leave. There were American flags waving now on some buildings, looking tentative and modest. Many Americans were moving toward the river and the Battery, some joking and laughing, others solemn. There were no Africans among them. Around noon, they saw the ship leave. The crowd cheered and blew whistles and small horns, and then grew quiet and started moving toward Broadway to wait for the procession of Washington. Part 6. The Time of the Countess. Cormac eased to his left outside the doorway of the basement room at 7 Cedar Street, trying for a better view of the slaughtered woman on the bed. A tall, mustached policeman barred his way.
Do you have a name yet, officer? Cormac said.
Dubious, the policeman said.
That's her name?
Yeah, Dubious Jones. No wonder he killed her.
He laughed a cop's dark laugh.
Who's the he?
Cormac said. The one who killed her.
Tucked if I know, the cop said.
Cormac kept making notes. A single thick candle burned down to a saucer, the wax glazing the table. A fine way to spend a birthday, he thought, walking toward the Evening Post on Pine Street. A fine way to celebrate another 9th of September in the year of the Lord, 1834.
Who killed Dubious Jones?
he asked himself. I don't care, he answered. The morning had been cool and quiet, and as always on his birthday, he walked to the edge of the North River and dropped a white rose into the flowing waters. As always, he wished for it to sail out past the many-masted ships and through the Narrows and into the Atlantic. With any luck, it would float all the way to Ireland. He sent that rose each year to his mother. As always, at the edge of the river, he thought about the coat of many colors and the magical pots simmering on the fire and her dark hair and wonderful smile. Then he went to work. That morning, as on most weekday mornings for the past 12 years, he left the river's edge and went to the office of the Evening Post on Pine Street. The morning was hot, with steamy August lingering into sweet September. The odor was beginning to rise from the streets, the buildings, the people. He spent the morning scanning month-old newspapers from London, Edinburgh, Dublin, and Paris, freshly arrived on the Liverpool packet. On slow days, he would cobble together stories from those newspapers. In a way, such work was like painting, which he did in the rooms on Cortlandt Street that he'd rented now for 16 years. You took various elements, you were precise about each one of them, but you made them fresh by the way you arranged them. The process kept his brain alert and alive, or so he thought, as the months became years and the years became decades. He liked the work of journalism from the day he started at the old Commercial Advertiser just before the century turned. The skills of the acting craft helped him in several ways. He could make himself gradually look older, so that when he announced his retirement from the Commercial Advertiser, he could go off, paint for a year on his savings, and then apply for work at the Evening Post as a new young man, eager to work on a newspaper. Cormac worked at his craft 10 hours a day, 6 days a week, which left him about 20 hours a week for his painting. He soon discovered that he needed both. The journalism to eat time, help it pass swiftly, to give him a sense of human proportion. The painting to slow it down, to allow him to meditate on sky and weather and the endless varieties of the human body. He had a talent for newspaper work, delighting in the discoveries of stories and then writing them in units of 500 or 1,000 words. There was one other part of newspaper writing that he came to need more than all the others, including the regularity of a paycheck. It was about other people, not himself. He walked to the office of the Post and paused at a stall on the crowded Broadway corner to buy a cup of mocha coffee and a piece of plain bread from a heavy black woman named Beatrice Machado.
"You look like you swallowed a boiled ferret, Mr. Cormac," she said.
"I feel worse than I look, Beatrice."
She leaned in and whispered,
"You need something special?"
"No," he said, "just a hot bath."
"Easier for to get a hot woman than a hot bath in this dirty old town."
Beatrice had been born a slave, up by Albany, but came with her parents to New York when she was 7, right after the Revolution, and had lived to see the final end of slavery in New York. That was just 7 years ago, 44 years after the Revolution. He sipped in silence as she poured coffee and handed sweets to other customers. Down Greenwich Street, he could see old black men sleeping in doorways or standing on corners, waiting for work that did not come. Their masters had held them to the end, and then were happy to see them go. They no longer had to care for these old men, no longer feed them and clothe them. Like almost everybody in the city, they asked about a place to wash. They were too old for the treacheries of the summer rivers, and there were no baths in the winter churches. Sometimes Cormac gave them a few pence and offered his apologies in Yoruba. He could do nothing about the water. Through the scalding summer, Cormac was like the abandoned Africans on the streets. He longed for water. He did not mind the heat. Some secret part of him, chilled by the Arctic winter of his Irish youth, would always be cold. He did mind the filth. At the Evening Post, Cormac could not convince the editors to make New York water as important a cause as independence for Greece or the compromise in Missouri over slavery. Still, Cormac made notes about the scandal of water. The major agent of the corruption was called the Manhattan Company. For decades after the Redcoats sailed away, it had controlled all water supply in New York through a corrupt charter.
Even Burr and Hamilton had been allies in the swindle, and its outline was simple. The spring of 1800, the Manhattan Company was awarded $2 million by Albany for this water project. But the deal had a nasty clause. It allowed the directors to use all unspent money for whatever purpose they desired. So they spent $100,000 on water and used the rest of the $2 million to start their bank, the Manhattan Bank. The result was the stinking city through which Cormac still moved each day. Alone in his flat on Cortlandt Street, Cormac was sometimes overwhelmed by rage. Rage against the men who had betrayed the revolution. Rage against the Manhattan Bank. The stinking odor of the town felt moral, a sign of its spreading corruption. And it was personal, too. For his own body carried a stench that he could not bring to even a casual coupling with a woman. For months at a time, he was celibate. He made drawings of women from memory, for the drawings did not send out an odor. And he brooded about the impossibility of forging a connection with any woman. Perhaps it was a curse conferred on him by Bridget Riley or Mary Burton, or both. An Irish form of voudon. They still came to him in dreams, smiling in knowing ways, stoking his fears, beckoning, retreating, betraying. Sometimes he even stopped drawing and painting. In those times, the longing for beauty seemed trivial in a city drowning in shit. At all hours, in all seasons, the city gave off a rotting stench. The miasma, they called it. The hod carrier emerging from a house on Hudson Street might say, "Sure, the miasma's not bad today, is it, Mick?" Or Bee Trees, presiding over mocha and biscuits, "Da miasma eat a hod out today, Mr. Cormac." Women tried to erase the miasma with perfume. Self-proclaimed gentlemen carried perfumed handkerchiefs in their sleeves. Some New Yorkers didn't care, for they'd been born into the smell of shit. The joke, Cormac must have heard it 30 times in 2 weeks, was about the New Yorker who wandered into the open country, collapsed of some infirmity, and revived only when a handful of shit was held under his nose. All the while, in spite of the stench, babies kept being conceived and born. They all entered the world of the miasma. But death huddled in the city's shit, and in 1832 it had risen in full fury. Omens preceded the dying. For 9 straight mornings in June, old Africans showed Cormac 2 black spots like angry eyes in the scarlet face of the rising sun.
"This is very bad," one said in Yoruba. "Many will die."
Then, on a Tuesday morning that same June, Cormac heard a tale from a Nassau Street barber. The night before, a neighbor named Fitzgerald came home from work as a tailor, and within an hour was simultaneously puking and shitting and bending over with cramps. He went quiet for a while, then groaned with headache. He screamed in thirst. The man was very still and quite dead. 5 hours after the first symptoms. Cormac rushed to see his new editor, William Cullen Bryant, a dry young poet. He explained what he'd been told by the barber. Bryant then was in his early 30s with a sharp nose and piercing eyes. He listened and whispered, "Good God, it's the cholera." Bryant told him to wait for more facts, above all to avoid spreading panic. That night Cormac's friend, the barber, died, along with his mother, aunt, and oldest child. They became numbers, as first 2 died each day, and then 20, and then the epidemic could no longer be hidden. Too late, the council began to clear the pestilential mounds of infested garbage. Sales of all newspapers fell as their rich readers departed and the illiterate immigrants were left behind. Advertising ceased, for few shops were open. Policemen were assigned to the abandoned churches and the empty houses of the rich to prevent looting, but soon they too were gone, fleeing the city or buried in its crowded trenches. Cormac discovered he seemed to be immune, but if this was life, he did not want it. Cormac was ignorant of the causes of cholera, but knew that it wasn't the Irish, blamed as the Jews were blamed for the Black Death, and knew it wasn't something as vague as the miasma. Whatever it was, science would discover the cause. He was convinced that the cure would come from water, cold water. Finally, it ended, after 9 terrifying weeks, and 3,526 known deaths. The rich slowly returned, sending in their African or Irish servants as the advance patrols, like canaries into a coal mine. Cormac urged Bryant to start a crusade in the Evening Post, demanding a strong, muscular supply of clean water. Bryant nodded, he listened, he thanked him. He published a few polite editorials. New York got no clean water. The miasma returned with the people. The cholera returned in 1833. Shit and filth got worse. The cholera returned in 1834. All that dying passed through him again as he went home after sundown on his birthday of September 9, 1834. The flat was an oven, so he went into the night. Near Broadway, he saw a woman come out of a tavern with a basket of wilting geraniums. He bought four of them and a length of string and tied them to his face, the petals tight against his nose. But then the smell of shit overwhelmed the flowers. He began to weep. He imagined leaping into the river and swimming away, an act of suicide. Motive, shit. And instead, turned right into Duane Street. His eyes searched the rooftops, looking for a water tower. There, he said. There, up there. On the roof of the Bordello near Chapel Street. She greeted him at the front door.
Do come in, she said. I'm the Countess de Chardon.
Cormac O'Connor, he said.
I've seen you in town, she said, but never, alas, in this place.
She was dressed as if married to one of the richest merchants in the city, with a swelling high-necked bodice that suggested, but did not display, full breasts. Her lustrous brown hair was piled in plaited coils held tight with a bone tiara. She was certainly no ordinary madam of a bawdy house.
Do have a drink, monsieur.
Cormac paused, and then said he'd much prefer a bath to anything else.
Yes, it's been a smothering day. I'll arrange a bath. Can you wait for...
I've learned to wait for everything, he said. She led him to a sitting room where mustached businessmen sat with some of the nine women who worked in the nine upstairs rooms. One young woman played Mozart badly on a stand-up piano. The Countess returned and motioned with her head for him to follow her. She led him up a back stairway to her suite on the top floor. Cormac relaxed. Thick drapes warded off the city, and the smell of shit was replaced by the scent of lavender. A tall glass-fronted bookcase was crammed with books in democratic disarray, the sign of a true reader. She was enthusiastic about Mary Shelley's Frankenstein. She loved Boccaccio, too. She was delighted that Cormac could name four of the seven traveling women: Pampania, Fiametta, Philomena, and Amelia.
They all work here, she said in an excited voice. Or at least, that is what I've named them. I'm waiting for the remaining three to arrive on my doorstep, women of the life who can also tell tales.
She casually opened a side door, and in the light of a candle he saw the bathtub, 7 feet long, up on golden lion's feet.
Would you like your bath now? She said.
Yes, I'd like that very much. She smiled in an enigmatic way and then pulled a cord. A tall, white-haired African man came in, and she told him to prepare coffee and the bath. He nodded and slipped away. When she heard that he was a newspaper man, a journalist, she asked what he thought about Lord Byron and Coleridge and her own favorite, Shelley. He gave glib answers. The African came in with coffee on a silver plate and then retreated to the bathroom, closing the door behind him. She asked Cormac about William Cullen Bryant.
His poetry is dreadful, no? Let's wash him out of our hair.
She led him to the bath. The clear-scented water was heated elsewhere and kept hot by a tray of coals beneath the steel-bottomed porcelain tub. The Countess opened his shirt. He opened her bodice with its eyelets and hooks. She then backed away while he completed his undressing. He hung his trousers on a peg. Then she returned wearing a thin white gown. He slipped into the healing water. The gown fell. She stepped in behind him, uttering a small squeal at the hot water, then squatted and wrapped her hands around his chest. Fingers caressed the ridge of dead flesh on his shoulder.
I love a man with a scar, she said. he's lived at least some small life.
In the months that followed, the bath was always the prelude. By day, he worked at the Evening Post. He went home now to the Countess de Chardon, where he lived in a small room down the hall from her suite. When she first saw him unpack his drawings, she was joyful. At Christmas, she bought him a new easel, brushes, paint, and paper. And so that he would not feel like a kept man, she commissioned him to do some drawings that she would use as decoration in the 9 rooms of her 9 young women. These were 9 views of her own vulva, and 1 view each of the vulvae of the other women. They were drawn in black and red chalk, in a Renaissance style, on tinted paper, and designed in such a way that a casual viewer would not instantly recognize the subjects. They could have been flowers. The Countess posed gladly, her knees drawn up, her rosy buttocks high on silken cushions. For Cormac, those were the months when there was no water anywhere in New York except in that house, the secret garden of the Countess de Chardon. She was lover, mother, teacher. But she never once used the word love and said nothing about the two of them forging a private pact. He didn't even sleep with her through the nights.
Nothing, she said, is more horrible than seeing each other after a night of sleep.
She didn't have any form of conventional jealousy, certainly not about the flesh, and definitely not about his flesh. As long as they began each evening with the bath, just she and Cormac, she didn't even mind if he made love to the other women. It was simply understood, without being said, that he would not develop any emotions for them beyond the simple needs of the flesh, and shared talk, and the details of food and books and music.
"You're always humming tunes," she said. "You should learn to play an instrument."
"Such as?"
"Such as the piano." "And who would teach me?"
"I would," she said.
And so she began teaching him.
"Time is everything in music," she said,
demonstrating with a booted foot the way to maintain tempo.
"In life, too," he said.
"Please, Cherie, it's too early for philosophy."
The tempo of his days was also shifting. A Scotsman named John Gordon Bennett was bringing something new to the newspaper trade. He had founded the Herald and, after some false starts, was beginning to find readers. He published the sort of details that Cormac put in his notes and failed to get into the Evening Post. The Evening Post began to run more tales of murders than before, discreetly, of course, and still buried in the rear of the newspaper. That meant more work for Cormac O'Connor. He moved around the town with a mask pulled across his lower face to reduce the miasma, checking with policemen and lowlifes for stories, humming the tunes that he was taught by the Countess de Chardon. And so music merged with water as he meshed more closely with the Countess de Chardon. Together, they often engaged in what the Countess called research. The suite and the bed and the bath were all part of the laboratory. She wanted to do with her body and Cormac's everything she could imagine as a woman. She guided him on some nights the way she guided him at the piano. Every house in New York had its specialties, and she wanted to keep changing the menu in hers. But there was a personal motive, too, for her own experiments.
"I don't want to die without trying everything at least once," she whispered to Cormac one night. "I don't know anything about the soul, but I want to know everything about the flesh, everything that I can possibly know, for I could die tomorrow."
So Cormac realized that he was also living with a woman who knew something about mortality, in a room on the top floor of a building on Duane Street, the palace of water and flesh and music. The Countess was one of his best sources. She knew stockbrokers and real estate speculators, police spies, and politicians. She discreetly fed private information to Cormac, who put some of it in the newspaper. She knew, above all, how New York worked.
"Everything is driven by money," she said. "The thing you must do is find out what is truly happening, not what seems to be happening. Start off by believing that everything is a lie."
She paused.
"The God story is a lie, told by archbishops to enrich themselves. Democracy is a lie. The police are a lie."
"And us?"
We're a lie too, she said with a smile. A good lie.
Cormac didn't hear them come in. It was after midnight on a frigid January night, and he was putting final touches on a somber portrait of a woman named Millicent. The Countess was off in her own room, humming Scarlatti. Then he heard a door slam down below, then voices raised, then something shattering. He went to the landing and looked down. Three men wearing rough cloth caps were confronting the Countess.
We'll close you down, you bloody whore, if you don't do what we say.
Get out of here now, she shouted back.
The heaviest man, his face still hidden to Cormac's view, shoved her hard against a banister. Cormac went into his room and took the sword off its hook on the wall. Then he moved silently down the stairs.
It's 100 a month, the big man was saying.
Cormac saw him clearly now. Huey Mulligan from the Five Points, one of the gang of young men called the Dead Rabbits. His face veined and red now, his eyes glittery with danger. Two others, smaller and younger, stood behind him. Most of the women were on the stairs. Mulligan glanced at Cormac as he came down and saw the sword.
Look, lads, this poof's got him a sword.
The two smaller men grinned and each drew a new English-style revolver.
You're in the wrong house, aren't you, Huey? Cormac said. If you want a woman, you should be at 13 Baxter Street. That is where your mother lives, isn't it?
Mulligan howled. You dirty bastard of a whoring ponce!
And charged. Cormac put the tip of the sword under the larger man's chin.
Oh, poor Huey Mulligan, Cormac said. What's that red stuff coming from your neck? Now, tell those two midgets of yours to hand those pistols to the Countess. If you don't, this sword will come out the back of your fucking head.
Mulligan made a gesture with his hands, directing the two smaller men to hand over the guns. The Countess took the guns, gazing at them with a curious respect.
Countess, you can now shoot these three idiots for breaking into your establishment.
What a marvelous idea, she said.
She shouted up the stairs.
Ladies, you saw what happened, didn't you?
A chorus of yeses. Cormac took the tip of the sword away from Mulligan's chin, and the big man swiped at his neck and saw blood on his fingertips. His nostrils widened in rage.
You've got some nerve, he said.
Cormac laughed out loud.
You come in here to break the place up and try to extort money, and we've got some nerve.
Mulligan turned as if to leave, then charged. He shoved Cormac against the banister of the stairwell, and Cormac fell, rolled, came up with the sword in both hands, and put its point against Mulligan's heart.
That was stupid.
He turned to the Countess, who was holding both revolvers. He nodded. She aimed.
Take off your shoes, Cormac said to Mulligan.
Then turned to the other two.
And you two idiots. Shoes, jackets, and trousers.
Within minutes, all three men were naked, using hands to cover themselves, and the chorus on the stairs erupted in applause. Even the Countess was grinning.
Now go home. If you run hard, you'll be warm enough, boys.
They went out, and Cormac saw that it was snowing. The next afternoon, with a foot of snow upon the ground, a mob showed up at the door of the brothel. It was led by clergymen who declared themselves firmly against sin. A few policemen watched carefully, but did nothing. There were no laws against prostitution, since, as the Countess observed, the laws were written by men. The age of consent in New York was 10. Watching with the Countess from a high window, Cormac saw Huey Mulligan and a dozen other dead rabbits on the edge of the crowd. Then one night, after a mild summer, when only 213 New Yorkers died of cholera, the Countess came to wake up Cormac in his room. The clock said 1:20.
They have a plan, she said, her voice breathless. They are going to burn out some blocks downtown, get rid of the old wooden houses.
She calmed herself and explained how she had learned from a favored customer that a certain group was planning to burn out some of the old streets because the land titles and squatting rights were now too complicated to deal with. Later, they would help move the rich up to the new districts in Greenwich Village. Everything below Wall Street would be rebuilt and devoted to business.
I should put this in the newspaper, he said, knowing that Bryant would surely find some excuse to refuse its publication.
Never, she said. They'll kill you, and worse. They'll kill me.
They both laughed. She rang for a maid and ordered two omelets, fresh bread, and a bottle of water. She swore Cormac to secrecy.
This is not about some stupid thuggy like Huey Mulligan, she said. This is about the big boys.
And then she mentioned names. Ruggles, Hewitt, Vandermeer, Astor. Months passed. There was no fire. There was at least serious talk now about building a reservoir in Croton, high in Westchester, and digging a system of pipes to carry fresh water to the city. The stranger arrived in November. It was just after midnight, and Cormac was sitting back deep in a plush chair while the Countess played an aching tune full of longing. Then, from beyond the door, he heard the music of a violin, playing in counterpoint to the music of the piano. The Countess stopped playing, and he saw shock in her eyes. She got up without looking at Cormac and opened the door. A man in a cape was standing there playing the violin.
Hello, Monsieur Breton, she said. Come in.
He stepped across the threshold, his hazel eyes taking in the room and falling upon Cormac. For the first time, Cormac saw the Countess appear awkward.
Cormac O'Connor, this is Yves Breton, she said in French.
Cormac stepped forward and offered a hand. Monsieur Breton ignored it.
You look well, Monsieur Breton said to the Countess. Better than I expected after what? More than 5 years?
How did you find me? She said.
Someone told me you were in New York, and I thought she could only be a whore.
Now he turned on Cormac.
Bring me a cognac, he said.
Cormac gestured toward the bar. The bottle's over there. Help yourself, Monsieur Breton. The Frenchman turned to the Countess.
Is he the butler?
No. He's my lover, she said.
Well, he said, every comte must have its servant.
Cormac stepped before him, anger quickening his pulse. You can leave now, my fiddling friend. There's the door. The Countess stepped between them.
Cormac, this is my husband.
That night, as on every night, he retreated to his room down the hall, but now everything was different. No word had passed to him from the Countess, but it was clear from her posture, her silence, and her eyes that he must stay away from the suite. He told himself that the Countess might only be testing him to see whether Cormac was indeed free of jealousy, and then realized that he was indeed suffering from a slippery attack of jealousy. He did not sleep well that night, or the next night, or the night after that. He plunged into reporting and put his energies into painting. He did not see Monsieur Breton. He saw the Countess on the fourth day after her husband's arrival in their lives.
I can explain, she said.
Then she told him some of her story, how she'd met Yves Breton in Paris, where her mother had brought her from New Orleans to study at the conservatory. Monsieur Breton was teaching harmonics and violin. He talked without pause about Goethe and Schiller and Madame de Stael, names she'd never heard in New Orleans, about the endless possibilities of music, about painters, about the way Napoleon was changing all of Europe and all of history. He became the first man she ever slept with.
It was like a summer storm, she said, and I have never regretted it. Everyone should fall in love in such a way, at least once.
Monsieur Breton was 11 years older than she was, 28 to her 17, a brilliant violinist. He had been too young to savor the enormous excitements of the revolution, but he remained a passionate follower of Bonaparte. Then came Moscow, and the end of the myth of invincibility.
By then, my mother and I were gone, the Countess said. We were back in New Orleans.
9 months later, Monsieur Breton arrived like a corsair. He courted her again, courted her mother too, charmed their friends who were enchanted by his music. And so they married. One rainy summer night, Monsieur Breton sat down and wrote a letter to his wife, explaining that he could not look at her without thinking of death, and then he vanished. She did not see him again, until now. When she was gone, he fell into bed in the dark, thinking of the Countess de Chardon. Now he knew much more about her than he had learned in all the months that came before, but the knowledge gave him no comfort. His stomach churned. He wanted to go down the hall and lie with her. He wanted to confront Michaud Breton. He lay there until night melted into dawn. For 4 days he worked harder than ever at the newspaper. He left the house on Duane Street early each day and returned late. Then, on a rainy Saturday night, he was at his pad of paper again, working up finished drawings from tiny sketches made on the street. His fingers ached for the piano, wanting to bring music out of his head and into the air. The door burst open and Monsieur Breton stood in the frame. His hair was unruly. His shirt was open to his chest. He had been drinking. "Come in," Cormac said.
"I am in."
"Then close the fucking door."
Monsieur Breton closed the door and gazed around the small studio. He glanced at the books and studied the drawings.
"Laurence Stern," he said. "Jonathan Swift, Gautier, Goethe. You're a reader."
"When there's time."
"I'm a musician," he said with a shrug. "Musicians don't read. They feel. They play."
"I've heard you play," Cormac said. "You're very good."
Monsieur Breton sighed.
"I've come here, Irishman, to apologize. My wife has told me the story, and of your arrangement, and of how you have comforted her."
The rain spattered the window panes now, and from away off to the west, Cormac heard thunder.
"So, Monsieur Breton, why did you come here?"
"To die," he said.
He didn't know where he had picked up syphilis. He was sure it was after he abandoned his wife in New Orleans. It could have been in Mexico City, where he played violin in a bordello on the Calle de la Esperanza, or in Veracruz. He wanted bodies warmed with the sun. He wanted to coarsen his talent with drink and women and the smothering stupor of heat. He was happiest in Italy, where he landed in 1829, playing in Frenchified Milano. He was already sick, although the first stage had faded, and cognac was the only consolation. Until suddenly some guttering ember of his youth burst into flame. Charles X in France decided to bring back the hard old authority of the old regime, smashing freedom of the press and dissolving parliament, and Monsieur Breton knew what would happen next. He took a coach to Paris in time for the July Revolution.
"I wanted to die on the barricades," he said. "A properly romantic death. One that would absolve all my sins."
He was wounded in the taking of the Hotel de Ville, with a bullet through his side. A woman nursed him back to health, a woman who loved him. When he could walk again, he fled.
"I couldn't give such a woman what I had," he said. "Couldn't kill her with my prick."
He shrugged again, shook his head.
"I don't sleep with her,"
he said, motioning at the door and the apartment of the Countess de Chardon.
"You should not worry."
3 nights later, Monsieur Breton insisted on a dinner for three in the suite of the Countess. He had bathed and was crisply dressed.
"I must play," he said,
and then took his violin and gave them the aching, then soaring melodies of the Symphonie Fantastique. Cormac saw tears welling in the eyes of the Countess and held her hand. When Monsieur Breton finished, they applauded him. Around 3:30 that morning, Monsieur Breton hanged himself. She buried him in St. Mark's in the Bowery. Cormac did not attend. That night, they resumed the habits of their lives together. In the morning, he sat down again to run his fingers on the keys of the piano. And yet it was not the same. A shadow had fallen upon them. He knew too much about her now, and she knew nothing of consequence about him. The old symmetry of unknowability had been upset, and he'd learned something about himself, too. After so many years, he could be jealous. As old as he was, that tangle of nerves still lived within him. And he knew a larger truth. He loved this woman.
Just after dark on December 16th, the Countess came to his room.
"They've done it," she said. "Pearl Street is burning."
When Cormac arrived at Pearl Street, the firemen were already wild with panic. The pumps didn't deliver the water that was needed. The water itself was frozen beneath the ground, in the shallow wells, in the rotting wooden pipes of the Manhattan Company. For hours, Cormac moved through the crowds, swollen now by other New Yorkers who had come to witness the calamity. Sparks and embers rose into the purple sky, and to Cormac looked oddly beautiful, like very slow fireworks. Those sparks and embers fell upon the shingled rooftops of other buildings. Beams crackled, bottles exploded and popped, and then there was a great whooshing sound as a roof came down upon an upper floor. Cormac the painter made sketches. Cormac the newspaperman made notes. Some citizens blamed the volunteer firemen for the chaos, and what more, some were looting the burning homes.
"We shouldn't pay them," one outraged citizen shouted. "We should hang them."
This had some truth to it. Around 2 in the morning, he saw Huey Mulligan and his boys moving out of buildings on the far side of the densest fire. All wore the leather helmets of the volunteer fire departments. All wore heavy coats with bulging pockets. The fire burned for 2 days, and firemen came to help from as far away as Philadelphia. When it was over, 20 square blocks and 697 buildings had been destroyed. The old wooden town was gone forever.
"I warned you," said the Countess de Chardon,
as Cormac stretched in her bath on the afternoon of the 17th and tried to scrub the soot and grime out of his hair and off his exhausted body. "And I kept my word and kept my silence. But you're in danger, Countess, because they know that you know." She pondered this, her face darkening. That night she decided it was time for a vacation in Paris. She would place a friend in charge of the house and vanish for a year. Would Cormac come with her? Cormac told her that he couldn't go to Paris, but he would be waiting for her in New York when she returned.
"It's nice of you to say that," she said in a melancholy way.
"I'll be here. I swear it." Later that night, they made love while snow fell upon the wounded city. She left for South Street before dawn, to board the black flag packet that crossed the winter sea to Le Havre. For 3 days and 3 nights, he never left the house on Duane Street. All day he played the piano, caressing the keys, trying to remember the melody of Berlioz while failing to club it out of the piano. At night he lay alone, his mind full of death. They all danced for him in the flickering light of a single gas lamp. His father waltzed with his mother. Bridget Riley danced with Mary Burton. The Earl of Warren danced alone, juggling 3 balls in 3/4 time. There was Quacko dancing with his wife, safe from the fires of the fort, while Congo watched in the shadows. Cormac hummed as the dance unfolded in the gaslit room and the snow fell steadily and he ached with loneliness. "It's time to go," he told himself. "It's time to move on. I have lived too long in this refuge with its water and scent of lavender. I have lived in a parenthesis of time, and now it has come to an end. The Countess is gone, and I must go too. I can't live in a haunted house." He found new lodgings on Mott Street. 4 days later, a mob of puritanical zealots, including Huey Mulligan, stormed the house on Duane Street, beating the women, rousting the customers, carting away the art and the candelabra and the furnishings, and then set the building on fire. 2 weeks after that, he was in the office at the Post when news arrived that the black flag packet to Le Havre had been lost at sea. There were 216 passengers on board. Cormac scanned the list. The name of the Countess de Chardon did not appear, but he knew she was among them. That same week, the clearing of the ruined houses was well underway. The work was done quickly, efficiently, almost ruthlessly. New buildings made of granite blocks and Corinthian pillars began to rise from the rubble. The most important of them looked like temples dedicated, of course, to Mammon. Part 7. Now. Cormac waits for the dark young lady on an evening of steady rain. He is in the backyard of a restaurant called East of 8th on 23rd Street, next to a movie multiplex. The wall behind him rumbles with explosions from a movie. Images of other 23rd Street theaters race through him, quick as rain. The tail end of the 19th century and New York changed again as everything moved uptown. The pigs were gone from the street. Another kind of swine took over the elegant Victorian sights. Electricity killed the darkness of midnight and drove elevators into the high floors of new buildings. Great armies of immigrants arrived at Castle Garden, speaking Yiddish and Sicilian and the English of Ireland. They were coming to the New Jerusalem, and the population soared to more than a million. Cormac fought brain sludge, writing dozens of preposterous novels for Beadle and Adams and the other fiction factories, into which he sneaked sympathies for unions and the poor and the despised Irish, along with his astonished love for the city itself. He moved from one newspaper to another, the rhythm of his life falling into a year of work, a year of disappearance. He began to see stories in the newspapers that entered him like knife thrusts. They were all small, social notes, really. A story of a woman at a party in London, and a young man who appeared at an opera opening in Paris. Another was found dead in Australia of heart failure. A fourth was living out west, beyond the Rockies, operating a mine. All were Warrens. All traced their descent to the Earl of Warren. He could not leave Manhattan to pursue them, but he feared their arrival on his granite island. "Please don't come to New York," he said out loud one night in the studio he owned on Duane Street. One of them did, Michael Warren, a handsome young fellow. He was on his way to London and was staying with friends in Gramercy Park. From the distant past, Cormac heard Mary Morrigan repeat the rules of the tribe. He remembered the way his father had died. He heard his father speaking. And then Cormac was relieved. One newspaper explained that this Michael Warren was leaving for London on the morning Cormac read the newspapers. There was no need to travel to Gramercy Park, to observe, to plan an ambush. No need to replace the sword he had lost the second night of the draft riots. When Cormac had gone out on that Tuesday night in 1863, he had strapped on the sword, thinking perhaps it could do its old work and save someone. At the corner of Cortlandt Street, he had seen a mob coming from Broadway, carrying a black man above their heads. Cormac had drawn his sword. "Stop, you fucking idiots!" he had shouted. "Put that man down!" One man had drawn a pistol, and Cormac had sliced off his hand. Then he had felt a sharp, sudden crack and fallen into a blinding whiteness. When he had come to, the sword was gone, stolen. Across all those years, he had love affairs. He made cautious friendships. He walked each year to the river on his birthday and dropped a flower in the flowing waters, hoping it would sail to Ireland. He sometimes longed for the Countess de Chardon. Now, as the March rain falls on 23rd Street, he rises up again from the past. "Hello," a voice says. He looks up, and she is standing above him, Delfina Cintron, smiling, her teeth very white in her dark face. "We can go inside," he says. "They have a table upstairs." She glances around the yard with its empty tables.
"This is fine," she says. "I like the rain."
He uses a white cloth napkin to wipe a puddle off a chair, and she sits down. The curls of her hair are tiny and fine and very black. For the first time in years, he wants to plunge his hands through hair until he can feel the curved bone of a female skull. Cormac remembers seeing her for the first time, walking on 14th Street on a day thick with August. Last year, last summer, the year of our Lord, 2000. Wearing low-cut jeans and a black halter with part of her smooth brown belly showing. Remembering how he had stopped that August day as she went by, stunned, short of breath, his heart pounding. Then there was a surge of pedestrians and he lost her, cursing himself for a goddamn fool. He came again to 14th Street at the same time, the same corner, arrived day after day for 3 weeks, hoping to see her in the crowd, to approach her. to try to know if this Dark Lady was the Dark Lady Congo had told him about, long ago in a cave in Inwood. In September, he saw her again at last, coming out of the new school on Fifth Avenue. She hurried into a drugstore, pushing the door sharply before her. He entered the drugstore in search of her, and there she was, behind the counter at the cash register. He saw her name tag, Delfina, the dolphin. Now she is here before him under a Cinzano umbrella. She is 28 years old. "Why are you alone?" he asks. "I'm not alone," she says, raising an eyebrow. "I'm sitting here with you in the rain." "You know what I mean," he says. "Why don't you have a man?" "I've had men," she says and shrugs. "Lots of them. I've even had a husband." Cormac doesn't press her. He didn't press her when he started going to the drugstore, once a week, saying hello, thanking her and calling her by name, until finally he brought her a brightly wrapped book at Christmas and saw astonishment in her eyes. Pablo Neruda, in English and Spanish. "Mil gracias," she said that day. Now tonight they are having dinner. On each date she has been guarded, careful, saying nothing of importance. She won't tell him where she lives and doesn't ask where he lives. "Do you want to talk about the husband?" Cormac says. "Your husband?" "No," she says. "He was a junkie." Neither speaks for several minutes as the rain drips. She looks directly at him now. "Does it bother you?" "You don't need to justify anything, Delfina. Not to me. Not to anyone." When they finish dinner, Cormac makes a scribbling sign to the waiter, who smiles and nods. She turns to Cormac and tries a smile.
"Okay. What about you? I told you something about me. Now you have to tell me something about you."
"It's a long story," he says. "Where do you want me to start?"
"I don't know. I know your name. I know you're some kind of a writer, and did you say you were an artist, too? A painter, right?" She pauses. "But the rest of it, I don't know anything. Like, how old are you?"
"Old enough to be your ancestor." She laughs. Cormac doesn't. Out on the wet sidewalk, he offers to take her home in a taxi. She thanks him and says she'll find her way. An invisible shield is forming. Delfina Cintron is backing away. "I'll call you," Cormac says. She nods in a casual way.
"See you," she says. "Thanks for dinner."
Then, looking cool and detached, Delfina Cintron adjusts the strap of her shoulder bag, thrusts her hands in the pockets of her raincoat, and starts walking quickly to the east. Cormac watches her go, feels the impulse to follow.